should know what I'm doing. But I don't.
Thank you.
And I should know what I'm doing. But I don't.
Ja, das war jetzt ein Ausschnitt, und zwar eine Arbeit von Susan Phillips auf der Berlin Biennale, die jetzt am 25. März in Berlin eröffnet wurde. Susan Phillips' Arbeiten bestehen im Wesentlichen aus zwei Elementen, eben Sound und Ort. Diesmal ist der Ort ein alter Garnisonsfriedhof, Kleine Rosenthaler Straße 3, auf dem die Jahreszahl 1722 des Rundportals am Eingang des Friedhofs sogar ein wenig irreführend ist, denn dies bezieht sich auf die Einweihung der Garnisonskirche, die sich einmal dort befand, wo die Anna-Luisa-Kahr-Straße in die Spandauer Straße mündet. Mit dem Verbot von Gruftbestattungen durch das preußische Landrecht 1794 entwickelte sich der Friedhof zu einer bemerkenswerten Begräbnisstätte, deren Grabmäler die wechselvolle preußische und Berlin-brandenburgische Geschichte dokumentieren. Die erhaltenen klassizistischen Steingrabmäler und die gusseisernen Grabzeichnen sind von kunstgeschichtlichem Interesse. Einige der Kreuze und Stelen stammen aus der königlichen Eisengießerei und bedeutenden Zinkgießereien Berlins. Viele sind nach Entwürfen von Karl Friedrich Schinkel 1781 bis 1841 gefertigt. Die Arbeit von Susan Phillips besteht darin, dass man auf dem Friedhof dann eine Soundinstallation zu hören bekommt. Und zwar eine, die darin besteht, I'm so lonesome, I could cry. Ist es nicht, sondern es ist eine Arbeit, in der es um das Leben geht, vom Hunger nach Leben, von Gefühlen wie Liebe, Verlust, Vertrauen und dem Bewusstsein vom Tode. Und diese nehmen die Zuhörerinnen auf eine intime Reise. Die Arbeit dauert insgesamt 45 Minuten und unterbricht das Alltagsgeschehen. Wir hören sie jetzt einfach nochmal. Of Mice and Man ist der Titel der Berlin Biennale von Mäusen und Menschen und wurde kuratiert von drei Kuratoren, einem Künstler, Maurizio Catalan, Massimiliano Gioni und Ali Subotnik. Diese betreiben seit 2002 gemeinsam The Wrong Gallery, eigentlich ein Ausstellungsraum in Chelsea, mitten in New York, in der New Yorker Galerienszene. Und darüber hinaus sind Catalan, Juni und Sobotnik Gründerinnen und Herausgeberinnen von Charlie, einer systematisch inkonsistenten Publikationsserie über zeitgenössische Kunst, mit dem Ziel eben Inhalte und Formate zu variieren, und sie wechseln jeweils das Erscheinungsbild und geben dann Bildern, künstlerischen Arbeiten, Artikeln und kürzlich veröffentlichtes Material darin auf und arbeiten Informationen aus. In diesem Zusammenhang wurde auch dann eine Publikation herausgegeben, Checkpoint Charlie. Und zwar ist das die Sammlung der insgesamt wohl 700 Künstlern, insgesamt wohl 900, die sie getroffen haben und deren Arbeiten sie dann zum Teil nicht ausgewählt haben. Und diese Arbeiten sind dann in Checkpoint Charlie alle versammelt und 70 Künstler wurden insgesamt dann gewählt. Wir hören jetzt zuerst ein Interview mit Ali Subotnik. Und zwar, sie arbeitet als Herausgeberin und Kuratorin und freischaffende Autorin in New York. Und seit ihrer ersten Tätigkeit für das Art Forum hat sie in verschiedensten Positionen und Funktionen der zeitgenössischen Kunst gearbeitet. Eben zusammen mit Maurizio Catalan und Massimiliano Cioni für die New Yorker Wrong Gallery und die Publikationsserie Charlie. Und sie war auch Herausgeberin und Redaktionsleiterin für Sonderausgaben des Magazins Parkett und arbeitete in der Redaktion von Art News. Ali Subotnik hat mit Onkar Vara, Hans-Ulrich Obrist, Francesco Visoli und die Dest Foundation in Athen an Publikationen gearbeitet und diese auch herausgegeben und schreibt für Freeze, Parkett, Art News, Art Review über Kunst und zeitgenössische Kultur. Und um die Auguststraße, durch die wir jetzt so ein bisschen hindurchgehen werden in Bezug auf die Berlin-Biennale, sie haben sozusagen eine Form der Rekonstruktion dieser Auguststraße auch geleistet, indem sie sozusagen auch dokumentarisch erklären, was und wie ist diese Auguststraße zu verstehen. Sie ist 900 Meter lang, hat 800 Einwohner, 20 Galerien und Kunsträume und ist sozusagen einer der weltweit wenigen Orte, in der alle Anwohner gleichzeitig in den Galerien ihrer Straßen verschwinden können. Spätestens seit 1998 hat sich die erste Berlin-Biennale für zeitgenössische Kunst hier, die hier stattfand, soweit etabliert, dass dieses Viertel, also diese Straße in Mitte sozusagen, das neue Chelsea des internationalen Kunstbetriebs eigentlich auch gelten könnte. Und diese Geschichte der Augestraße ist in dem Sinne auch dann die Geschichte eines neuen Berlin-Mythos, nämlich dem 8 Jahre nach der ersten Berlin-Biennale, auf der international bekannte Künstler vorgestellt wurden, dann den Mythos von Berlin als Kunstmetropole zu festigen, 14 Jahre nachdem eben Kunstwerke und Biennale-Gründer Klaus Biesenbach, der eine Schau kuratierte, nämlich 37 Räume in leeren Wohnungen, ungenutzten Hallen, dann in dem noch sehr maroden Quartier eben Kunst gezeigt hat. Und dies ist sozusagen die vierte Berlin-Biennale, die dann wieder diesen geografischen Ausgangspunkt Berlin-Mitte sozusagen thematisiert, indem im Rahmen der Berlin-Biennale sehr viele neue Ausstellungsräume überhaupt genutzt werden, genauso auch Wohnungen, ein Friedhof, eine Kirche, ein Pferdestall, die Kunstwerke und auch die jüdische Mädchenschule. Und darauf werden wir dann zum Schluss kommen. Jetzt zuerst das Interview mit Ali Subotnik hier am Mikrofon, Felicia Herrschaft.
Talking about these things would be great. Just listen.
Yeah, Ali Subotnik. Probably we should start by explaining how you started to work here in Berlin together with Maurizio and Massimo organize.
The three of us have been doing projects together for several years, I think since 1999 or 2000, and they were always really sort of experimental and flexible and playful, because we did them with whatever money we had in our pockets or no money. Like, the Wrong Gallery was really no budget at all, and we relied on our friends and neighbors, basically, to help us out. And we were it was an experimentation in what you can do within limits, and being able to do really interesting shows in a teeny tiny space that was 1 square meter, that's within all these galleries that are so gigantic and huge and have so much money, that we could still show some of the same artists and do these really interesting things with no money. And a lot of the artists enjoyed the freedom, less pressure in a way. But then people sort of started taking us seriously, I guess. And we also published Charlie. It's a publication series on contemporary art, and it changes each issue. And Massimiano had just done Manifesta in San Sebastian, and he was nominated for the Berlin Biennial. And what he proposed was that the three of us do it together. And there was a couple rounds in the selection process, and I think they really wanted something different than the previous biennials, and it was an interesting combination to have an artist and then also a curator. And I'm, with Massimiano, and I write and curate. And, so they decided that to give us a chance. And so for us, it's the first time we've worked with institutional backing, with the money and the staff and all the resources. So it's been fantastic in that, like, this is the most unchaotic and smooth and pleasurable installation experience I've ever had. I mean, nobody cried, no chaos. Wow. Our staff was just amazing. They were so prepared for every little thing. And earlier on, we were like, why do they need to know all these details? They're insane. But in the end, it paid off because it was so enjoyable. The artists are so happy, and I think it really helps make a fantastic show. I mean, I'm just really happy about it.
Yeah.
But for us, it was such a huge change to go to working in this environment, because we would be really spontaneous and flexible, because it was just the three of us making decisions. And here we had to, go really discuss it with more people and all these different departments, and things take a lot more time, and there's rules to follow. But it was, for us, we saw it as a challenge and an experiment and an opportunity. And it has been really fantastic that we've shown and tried it and shown that we can work in a different setting. And I think the main thing is that we can do something serious as well, because a lot of people think, I mean, even with the Wrong Gallery, we were serious, but people took it as a joke. So I guess it took us getting this sort of support, financial and institutional, to show that we can be serious. And what the reason we're all here doing this is because we love art, so we really focused on the art making the show.
Yeah. So what kind of details do you mean were important that it was
to make it run smoothly?
Yeah.
Our staff, we have this fantastic artistic office, and they would ask the artist, all these details about, from the framing, things that you need to know. But when they would ask about the framing, they would need to know, every little corner and where the hooks go and all these things that maybe most people wouldn't even think about. They just get the basic information. But they got every little detail for their bios, for their how the shipment was going to happen, what they're going to put on the customs form, who the courtesy goes to. I mean, all that stuff was done before installation started, which was really smart of them, because then during installation, everyone focused on installation and getting the works up, and there was a great crew that, they had at least 2 people per artist to work with them, and a good schedule. It was very planned, well planned.
So you had the chance by this organization to be concentrated on the art.
Yeah.
Art and the art scene here in Berlin.
Yeah, I mean, by coming here, we really sort of dove our head first into Berlin, because we were so curious and really wanted to learn what the city is like, because if we were going to do a show here, you kind of have to, I mean, it would be ridiculous if we tried to just come here and put on a show and not look at the city. Mm-hmm. But also we knew there was no way we could really know Berlin in such a short time. So we did our best in experiencing it, but we knew that there's so many things that we were probably missing, because one of the things we found about Berlin is that there's so much going on in so many different sort of circles that certain things you could miss if you don't know about, like, you know, you can walk right by a gallery and not know it's there because it's in some, like, apartment or something like that. So it was a lot of learning, but it was also, we couldn't make it seem like this is a show about Berlin, or this is, or, you know, try and assume that we know Berlin now, because mm-hmm. we know one side of it or one experience of it. We know Auguststrasse quite well, I could say.
So we were always fucking around, and
yeah, we didn't leave here much.
So it, but you started here with this art diary.
Yes.
And how was that reflected or important to start with the city questions, creating question, and the art diary?
It was important for us, so we started with the city and meeting artists here, and also one of the things we did is everyone kept telling us about young artists to meet, and we asked who the oldest artists were, and that was Dorothy Iannone and Emmett Williams, and they were really inspiring for us because their work was so relevant still, and they were such exciting people and had, like, lived through the history of Berlin because they've both been here for so long.
Mm.
And they sort of, meeting all these other artists in Berlin and them, we knew really from the beginning that we didn't want to just wait and have an exhibition that was just one show and that's it. We knew for us it's a good exercise to do projects and keep ourselves thinking and working. And that whole process of putting on shows and events up until this big show was extremely important. So we had an idea for a project space from the beginning. So that's how Gagosian came.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also a way for us to learn from Berlin, because we invited different people to curate each show, except for the first one we did with Dorothy and Emmett and Dieter Roth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way for us to work with a lot of the artists that we did find that we really liked their work, but maybe it didn't fit in the context of the show, or, you know, for various reasons wasn't going to be in the big show, but we still wanted to work with them, and that's Gagosian is a great channel for that. And then with Charlie, we wanted to, you know, we'd looked at so many files and so many artists. And for us, it was like part of our instinct to try and share what we got, what we learned with the community, mm-hmm. and to give something back to the artists, because we ask them for all this stuff and they send all this stuff. And then they just maybe don't ever hear from you again or get disappointed if they're not in the final show. And for us, it was a way of showing that there's so many other shows that could have come out of this,
mm-hmm.
and ours is just one. We don't know it's the best way. It could have been so many different things, and we made one show, but Charlie has, like, millions of shows within it. A lot of artists were upset with us because we didn't ask permission, but for us it wasn't a way of saying, oh, these are the people that aren't in any way. It wasn't mean-spirited. It was really about sharing with the community and with the artists, you know,
yeah.
what we got from them, you know, yeah. It was much more for us about communicating and, you know, just that our opinion isn't necessarily the opinion, you know, and there's all these other possibilities.
Mm.
So doing those extras, the Gagosian, and we also did this column in Zitti magazine, those projects really enabled us to engage more with the city, to keep our brains going. Because, you know, we would do research, and at the beginning we were here every other month, so you can lose momentum, or every time we'd come we'd get so caught up in all these meetings that we wouldn't have a chance to really just look at works. And so it was harder to keep things fresh in our mind, but by doing Gagosian, the column, and Charlie, it kept us really thinking and working and seeing constantly, so that every idea led to another idea.
Mm.
And it was also, you know, a way to play with the whole idea of a biennial, you know, of it being the static exhibition that lasts, you know, month or two. But it could be longer than that. And we had the luxury of time and the finance, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the places you found mm-hmm. now here in this street, like using this Jewish mm-hmm. girls' school. And how did you recognize
it? It started out that, you know, we knew Kunstwerke was a venue, but it was pretty open what the others would be. And Martin Gropius Bell was one of the ones that was offered to us, and we...
It was used for 2 years.
It was used, yeah. I think just once, just the last one, the previous biennial. Yeah. We didn't feel like that was so conducive for contemporary art, and it wasn't exactly the space we wanted to work with. It has a huge history, maybe even stronger than the school. I mean, it's a different history. But basically, we just looked across the street and said, what is that building? And they said, oh, it's, you know, this Jewish school, it's been closed for 10 years. And we said, well, can we look at it?
Mm.
And they were like, no, you'll never get in. And we said, well, just ask.
Yeah.
And so they asked, and we got an appointment to go in. And someone took us on a tour of the hospital and the school, and we were just blown away. You know, for me, it was such an intense experience. And at first, I wasn't comfortable with the idea of even using it because it was so intense.
Mm.
But it was a fantastic challenge to really confront and accept the history and accept that building represented a time, but also when we got the building, to move along on the street and sort of address all the different times and all the different histories. So yes, the Holocaust and the Nazis, it's a huge, huge impact on this area and on the city and everything. But we couldn't let that, like, control or limit us in any way. So we wanted to just, like, go with that and then also explore all the different other histories and lives that have been lived here. And so by using this one street, it was a way to sort of look at it as a microcosm and sort of relate it to a universal ideas and emotions. And for us, it was really looking at work and works that an artist that we knew could do something within these spaces, that their work was strong enough and they had enough confidence to place their work in such a contextual space that's not just a white cube. And it seemed to work quite well. The artists were really excited about it, and, you know, we sort of made this, like, it's like a life cycle in a way. I mean, it sounds so sentimental and cheesy, but you know, you go from the church to the cemetery, and you go in and out of these places where people live and pray and eat. And to see art in that context is actually quite an old idea. You know, churches have always been places where you see art. And
schools,
not so much. I mean, in the art class, maybe.
Yeah.
Murals sometimes, but different kind of art. You know, but in private homes. It's just, you know, the ballroom.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, even the cemetery, they have this building, the lapidarium, for the tombstones of, made by, you know, Schinkel and all these famous architects that are, it's like a museum in itself, you know. Mm. The whole cemetery is like a museum. They have the front houses used for exhibitions about the history of the cemetery.
Mm.
So we sort of, you know, used what we found and tried to leave things as they were and let the artists work within that context and...
Yeah.
See what happened.
So, wir gehen jetzt zuerst durch die jüdische Mädchenschule und hören dort verschiedene Arbeiten. Zuerst muss man durch eine Waffenkontrolle gehen in der ehemaligen jüdischen Mädchenschule. Und obwohl diese Mädchenschule seit 10 Jahren nicht benutzt wurde, sind im Rahmen der Ausstellung, ist dies der einzige Ort, in der aufgrund der Bestimmungen der jüdischen Gemeinde Waffenkontrollen durchgeführt werden. Dort bei der jüdischen Gemeinde habe ich nachgefragt und mit Peter Sauerbaum gesprochen und in Bezug auf die Sicherheitsmaßnahmen, die dort eingeführt wurden, weil die jüdische Mädchenschule auf dem Gelände der neuen Synagoge steht, ist es nicht möglich, darüber zu sprechen. Darüber redet man nicht. Wir reden darüber nicht, war die Antwort. Und inwiefern das nicht zu bereden ist, kann man vielleicht dann zum Schluss noch eine andere Perspektive einnehmen. zu sagen ist zu diesem Gebäude, der Architekt und Gemeindebaumeister Alexander Beer entwarf das Schuhgebäude, eines der letzten Neubauvorhaben der jüdischen Gemeinde vor der Machtergreifung der Nationalsozialisten. Beer baute modern, klare, symmetrische Formen, die eben dieses fünfgeschossige, L-förmige Gebäude bestimmen. 1930 zog die jüdische Mädchenvolksschule für Schülerinnen zwischen 6 und 13 Jahren in das Gebäude ein. Sie war in erster Linie eine Schule für arme Mädchen sowie Waisen aus dem benachbarten Kinderheim Ahava, hebräisch für Liebe. Die Schule blieb während der 1930er Jahre geöffnet, trotz der zunehmenden Verfolgung seitens des nationalsozialistischen Regimes. Am 30. Juni 1942 wurden dann alle jüdischen Schulen auf Anordnung des Reichsministeriums für Wissenschaft, Erziehung und Volksbildung und des Reichssicherheitshauptamtes geschlossen. Danach wurde diese Schule in der Auerstraße in das Schulsystem der DDR dann integriert und 1950 zog die Polytechnische Oberschule Bertolt Brecht ein. Der Filmemacher Günther Jordan drehte seinen Dokumentarfilm Berlin-Auerstraße 1979 in der Bertolt-Brecht-Oberschule. Nach dem Mauerfall ging dann das denkmalgeschützte Gebäude im Zuge des Restitutionsprozesses wieder in den Besitz der jüdischen Gemeinde zurück, musste aber wegen sinkender Schülerzahlen 1996 geschlossen werden. Seitdem sind die Räume unberührt geblieben. Bis heute findet man Spuren der wechselvollen Geschichte, Tapeten und Materialien aus verschiedenen Zeiten, Reste der technischen Ausstattung der ehemaligen Physik- und Chemieunterrichtsräume, Wandmalereien und Graffiti in den Gängen. Die denkmalgeschützte ehemalige jüdische Mädchenschule wird zur vierten Berlin-Biennale erstmals seit 1996 wieder für die Öffentlichkeit zugänglich.
Ganz kleinen Moment, bitte.
Drängen Sie sich immer vor.
Ich dränge mich nicht vor. Ich warte.
Ja, ich war vor Ihnen dran.
Ja, Entschuldigung.
Ja.
Ich dachte, Sie hatten einen Kater mal. So, jetzt links ist hier bitte rein. Und in Fließende Basket. Deutsch, Englisch?
Deutsch.
Super. Danke sehr.
Die Arbeit, die man gleich hören wird, ist die von Viktor Alimpiev. Und zwar ist das eine Videoarbeit, die in Zusammenarbeit die Summer Lightnings heißt. Und zwar ein Gegen- und Miteinander wirken von Naturgewalt und Menschenschutz. In einem unbestimmbaren Klassenraum trommelt eine Gruppe kleiner Mädchen mit lackierten Fingernägeln auf Tische wie Sekretärin auf Schreibmaschinen und bietet ein Bild des Wahns. Unterbrochen wird das Szenario von Aufnahmen fernen Wetterleuchtens oder plötzlichen Innehalten der Mädchen. Gespannte, belustigte, ernste, ängstlich wartende Gesichter dicht vor der Kamera, bevor sich die seltsame kollektive Übung wiederholt. Yeah, and to see this Paul McCarthy work.
Though, yeah.
It's amazing.
It's so amazing because especially when you look at the wallpaper, it's everyone is just astonished. It looks like it was part of the school.
Yeah.
And this is a piece he made in 92, but it was a piece that we started talking about at the beginning when we saw the gymnasium when we first started looking at the school was full of props from a theater company. So we couldn't even see really what the room looked like. I mean, it was fantastic. It was full of all these crazy things. It was actually quite scary. Like, you couldn't see the walls or you know, the sides. So we had no idea what this room was like.
Yeah.
And when it was emptied, we were just blown away.
Yeah.
And, you know, had the McCarthy piece in mind for quite some time. And then there was an issue about whether it was going to fit through the door, and it just is so fantastic.
And
there.
With his sport instruments.
Yeah, the ladders and everything. I mean, but we could barely see that stuff when the props were in there,
yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So it was a real special treat.
It's a good
and it's just, yeah, that piece that I find it is so fantastic there and so resonant and has so many, I don't know, connections that it brings up and feelings and it's quite intense, but it's also fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun and scary. And
yeah, that's right. Yeah, when I went there, I was really shocked by the controls.
Uh-huh.
And I asked why I had their controls.
Oh, wasn't it on?
It got for weapons and all this stuff. And I asked, why are you doing this? It's an exhibition space, so is there really a need for this? And this guy said from the security, yeah, because where do you come from? That was his first question. And I said, from Western Germany. And he said, well, in Berlin, it's normal. We need that.
Yeah.
There's so much terror.
I mean,
I don't know. Is it really?
I don't know that it's necessary. But we have to respect them.
That's why they need it still.
I mean, I think it's just it's an extra measure for safety and protection. I really don't think it's necessary that they're under any kind of threat.
Yeah.
But we respect them and appreciate their allowing us to use this space. And so we, of course, are going to, obey their, go along with those conditions.
Yeah.
Which, I don't think it compromised us. It sets up a strange entrance and introduction to the show, but it's a part of life. And it's also very today, you know. We do go through those things at the airport millions of times now, and now it's some schools, like a lot of schools in the States actually have them because of the kids bringing guns and knives to school, so it's really sort of scary and confrontational, but also it's very real.
Yeah, so, and it's really a great space. It's so...
Each room has its own special sort of feel, and the layers of wallpaper and the paint falling off. We left all of that because it was just... There's no way you can clean something up like that unless you have just millions of dollars.
Yeah. So Paul McCarthy, he had his work from 92, and did he change anything?
No.
No. It was really placed like this.
Yes, this is the same piece. And,
okay. Yeah, that's good. And who of these artists... created work.
New works?
Yeah.
Mark Manders was one of the first artists we brought here, and he chose basically, we see him as the final final room in the Jewish school, and he is doing this ongoing piece. It's basically a self-portrait. It's a sculpture of a building. I might be getting the title off, but it's self-portrait as a building, I think. And it's this just process of sort of building up and extracting the self with different symbols. So here he's got this five-room floor plan made out of things like cassette tapes and pens and pencils and other daily, rulers and everyday objects. And then in the middle there's a figure who's divided in half, and it's standing on a pencil that he made out of steel.
Yeah.
And it's so human and so touching, and it's scary and it's beautiful. And then on the other side, it's sort of like he lays out all the different stages and in different facets of the mind, because there's like animal type figures and a set of lungs and a baby, but it's really obscure. And like his work, it's actually quite hard to articulate exactly what he's doing, but it's just so personal, and it's very emotional, I find. And he really got excited about the space and worked within the space. And you know, one of them he has closed off so that you can't even enter, because it's really something he wants you to just sort of look at, instead of trying to pay attention to what it's made up of and looking at all these little details. You look at it and you really see it as almost like a painting, that you know, to take it in that way. So he did something specific for that.
Hier im Hintergrund hört man Nathalie Djurbergs Arbeit, und sie zeigt Kinderfilme für Erwachsene und nutzt sozusagen die Freiheit und Symbolik der Märchenwelt, um Geschichten zu erfinden. Diese Geschichten zeichnen sich durch eine verunsichernde Zweideutigkeit aus. In Tigers Licking Girls Butt macht ein Tiger, der wie ein Kuscheltier aussieht oder direkt dem Dschungelbuch entsprungen zu sein scheint, wiederholt genau das, was der Titel beschreibt. Das Mädchen dreht sich um, als ob sie ihn ermahnen will, doch stattdessen lässt sie sein Verhalten durchgehen und am Ende ermuntert sie ihn sogar. Der Text "Why do I have this urge to do these things over and over again" erscheint viermal im Lauf des Videos. Djurbergs zuckersüße Arbeiten machen die dunkle Seite, das Verdrängte, Verlogene und Böse des menschlichen Wesens immer wieder sichtbar.
The Train by Robert Kusmorowski, he had done it once for his like graduation show. We asked him to redo it there. When we saw this big auditorium, we saw that it was the perfect place for that piece.
Yeah.
And so he's been here since February 15th working on it, and it's just monumental, and that's also a really hard piece. It's tough. You know, it brings up a lot of associations with the deportation and so many issues, but it's like, train's a train, you know, the trains existed before the deportations, and it has such a long history, the train and travel and mobility. But how does a train get on the third floor of a building, too? So it has many different ideas sort of revolving around it. But that was something specific made for the school.
Yeah.
Mike Boucher has his Dirty Room, which is sort of his version of Walter de Maria's Earth Room in New York, which actually de Maria had done twice in Germany for the first times.
Yeah.
And so it's done with compost from the prison at Tegel. And now it's actually growing sprouts and fills three rooms. And it's just like so pretty. And
it's
like
nice.
I actually got to run around in it.
And then have this work from Henri Salat.
Yeah. And you hear the street, the cars coming by. And it's a really nice combination with those two.
Is that a place in Albania?
Yes, it's in Tirana. And he just saw this horse on the road and was like, why is this horse just like sitting there not moving? And he pulled out his camera. The horse just stood there. All it does is lift up its leg.
Yeah.
It was like so scared and I mean, but you'd think a horse would like get out of the way or go somewhere. It just stayed there.
Yeah.
The little moments that can be so beautiful and have so many different associations. And Henri Salat is very good at capturing that.
Yeah, that's right. And this Felix Gmelin work is...
Felix is fantastic. He finds he does a lot of things with found footage. And his father, he has a lot of his father's films and archives. And this is a series from Swedish television, or it was made for Swedish television, and it was about...
The 70s.
Yeah, it was about 60s or 70s, about equal rights.
Yeah.
And so there was one that was done on sex education, and one that was done, I think, on sexual relations. And then this one was about... it was part of the sex education, I think, and it's blind students learning about anatomy. So they have these naked models in front of class, and students are led up and you know, their hands are put on their genitals and they touch and feel, and that's how they learn. I mean, why it was filmed, I don't know. I mean, because the kids can't see it filmed. I mean, I guess it was filmed about teaching this kind of education, but it was also a little twisted. And then on the monitor, it's Felix and his father, and they're, I don't know, doing really strange things. And then the soundtrack is from deaf children, I think it's deaf children, learning how to speak, so they make these noises like... and hearing that from down the hall is so amazing, too.
Yeah, that's right. And Cassie Wilkes' work was really a kind of mystery.
Yeah. A lot of people are like, what? I mean, Kathy is so intense. Her work is extremely autobiographical. They're basically details. It's almost like she's giving parts of herself, and she opens them up and spreads them around.
Yeah.
And so it's parts of herself that she takes out of herself, and then things that she sees that are in her world.
I walked over the blade.
Yeah, no one's supposed to, like, walk. I mean, there's all... I mean, sometimes it's just a thread, and it's part of the piece. Okay. And it's, like, all these little things, and it's... You know, she's really
deconstructing.
Deconstructing herself, and also just, like, breaking herself up into... Hmm. All these little elements that are quite obscure.
Yeah.
You know, but she works so hard on each placement of every little detail, and it's also kind of a continuing project for her, where she keeps building more and more and changing things around and adding and taking away.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And this work, I don't remember, that was that work where Reynolds was... The burning.
Yeah.
What is that?
I mean, it's interesting. He's an American artist, but we came across his work here.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful and scary that these people are just sitting in this house that's burning to the ground, and they don't move, and it's just the wonder of fire and the wonder of, like, this terrible, horrible thing's happening, but it's made into this beautiful thing. It's quite sublime, I guess.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of... but to come back to the concept of mice and men, if there are always probably... Or if you are thinking about trauma, there are broken narratives through... if people are traumatized, probably... So how is this located, this idea of there's birth, loss, death, surrender, grief, nostalgia? Mm-hmm. Or why is it located to that idea of...
Of trauma?
No, of mice and men.
Well, of mice and men shouldn't be taken so literally. For us, we're not saying that the exhibition is like the book, like the novel. And the line came from... a poem, a Scottish poet, Robert Burns. And for us, the show, as we were putting it together, we realized that, I mean, because we really would just look at works and see works and come up with, get attracted to certain types of work, and together, as we would see how they were working together, we noticed that, first one thing was that they were extremely dark and very introspective. But also there was a lot of people and figurative, like, faces, and the person was really strong image, and animals. And, the title just seemed to work well. It was, it's for us, it's quite poetic and abstract and romantic, but it also does have a lot of resonance. I mean, if you look around the show, there's a lot of animals and humans, and it's also... connects with their just interest in this reality and seeing these artworks in real places.
Yeah, I think there is a connection then between this how Bruce Nauman is placed and Otto Mühe at the end.
Yeah. We don't shy away from this Big Bang. No, it's
from heads to bodies. Something like this.
From rats to bats to monsters and
When I started at the
at the end, and I had this idea, it's more from monsters and men. From monsters and men.
Yeah.
And, but what do you think? Is there something changing in this aesthetic from the iconography? And if there is this installation where two people are dancing in the ballroom,
kissing.
People kissing, and in this, if artists have more and more in spaces, interactions, touching bodies in a kind of specific aesthetic way.
I mean, I don't know that, like, the touching bodies thing. I mean, that's pieces. He does most of Tino Segal's works. He finds people to sort of express ideas, and he directs them. He's choreographs, basically. So that piece, they're illustrating three or four artworks that have kiss scenes. So it's Gustav Klimt, Rodin, Brancusi, and Jeff Koons. And it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I had never actually seen it. I knew of the piece, and when he said he wanted to do that, we were so pleased, and it's such a perfect space, and it's such a beautiful piece.
Yeah.
You never would, when hearing the idea, it's kind of strange, and then to see them. And it's also, you know, people are really shy and just stay sort of at the door and are afraid to go in and enter the space. But it's really interesting to be able to watch them together and acting out this really slow, sensual dance.
Yeah.
It's quite beautiful. But, I mean, as far as, like, there's being an overall trend, I think that wasn't an issue we were trying to confront, you know, what is happening now. It was more like something that we connected with and that we saw in a lot of the works was more of the humanity rather than just the body or trauma. You know, it is like we can't say that it's completely disconnected from the time because there is a lot of fear right now and a lot of reasons to be sad in the world. It's like it never goes away, but I think recently it's sort of come back more intensely, at least as an American, and since 9/11 it hasn't gone away at all. And I feel it here when I come here. It's just, there has not been a full recovery, and I don't know if there ever will. You know, this is a really scarred nation, and especially the city. And, you know, it has a different, it's never gonna overcome that past, but it's learning how to work within it and accept it, I think.
And why do you think artists able to express these atmospheres or their identities in this environment?
I think just the artists that we decided to work with or that we met all have this tendency to look within themselves and, I guess, to the spaces presented them a way to almost emphasize further that personal aspect because the spaces have so much of a personal background in a way. Like, they're not just empty of all meaning. Mm-hmm. So they could maybe relate more to the fact that this school has such a strong history because they've got their history and they're looking at themselves inside, and then to go into the space that has all the stuff inside the walls that you may not see but you feel, kind of. So there was a similarity in that, maybe. And, you know, I think it's also exciting for some artists to be able to work outside of the normal spaces that they're used to and see their work in a different way. And some of them, it was a big challenge that we really had to say, come on, just try it. Please try it. And then, man, they were so happy with how it turned out.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hier hören wir jetzt die Arbeit von Ulf Aminde, und zwar eine Soundinstallation in der Auguststraße. Das Leben ist kein Wunschkonzert, ein Work in Progress, begonnen als Videoinstallation. Er lässt Straßenmusikerinnen unterschiedlicher Herkunft, teils Laien, teils Profis, auf seine Anweisung hin einen bestimmten Ton oder Rhythmus spielen. Was sie daraus machen, bestimmen die Musikerinnen selbst. Jeder wird auf seinem eigenen Monitor gezeigt. Im Zusammenklang ergibt sich ein eigenartig disharmonisches Orchester. Auch in dieser Arbeit schafft der Künstler den Rahmen in Form einer Handlungsanweisung, überlässt aber den Spielerinnen das Feld, um davon durch den Schnitt oder die Präsentationsform des Realen wiederum zu fiktionalisieren. In den Pferdeställen des Postvoramts ist eine Arbeit zu sehen, und zwar die von Jeremy Della. Er nutzt Musik als Folie für gemeinsame Interessen und hat in diesem Zusammenhang die Klezmer-Schule Govenberg gefragt, ob sie Klezmer spielen werden, und die Musikgruppe Klezmer Shidesh entwickelt dann eben ein gemeinsames Projekt und bringt so Melancholie und intensive Lebensfreude dieser traditionellen Musik in den Kontext der Kunstausstellung in der Auguststraße. Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft. Das war eine Sendung über die Berlin Biennale, die bis Ende Mai, 28. dort zu sehen ist. Ein Interview mit Ali Subotnik haben wir gespielt. Bis dann.